and she longed to be out of this narrow, boxy cabin. She longed to be north already in the wide snows under the blazing aurora. And sometimes she longed to be back at Jordan College, scrambling over the roofs with Roger, with the steward's bell tolling half an hour to dinner time and the clatter and sizzle and shouting of the kitchen. Then she wished passionately that nothing had changed, nothing would ever change, that she could be Lyra of Jordan College forever and ever. The one thing that drew her out of her boredom and irritation was the alethiometer. She read it every day, sometimes with Father Coram and sometimes on her own, and she found that she could sink more and more readily into the calm state in which the symbol meanings clarified themselves, and those great mountain ranges touched by sunlight emerged into vision. She struggled to explain to Father Coram what it felt like.
It's almost like talking to someone, only you can't quite hear them, and you feel kind of stupid because they're cleverer than you, only they don't get cross or anything. And they know such a lot, Father Coram, as if they knew everything, almost. Mrs. Coulter was clever, she knew ever such a lot, but this is a different kind of knowing. It's like understanding, I suppose.
He would ask specific questions and she would search for answers.
What's Mrs. Coulter doing now?
He'd say. And her hands would move at once, and he'd say,
Tell me what you're doing.
Well, the Madonna is Mrs. Coulter, and I think my mother, when I put the hand there. And the aunt is busy, that's easy, that's the top meaning. And the hourglass has got time in its meanings. And partway down there's now. And I just fix my mind on it.
And how do you know where these meanings are?
I kind of see them. Or feel them, rather. Like climbing down a ladder at night, you put your foot down and there's another rung. Well, I put my mind down and there's another meaning. And I kind of sense what it is. Then I put them all together. There's a trick in it, like focusing your eyes.
Do that, then, and see what it says.
Lyra did. The long needle began to swing at once and stopped, moved on, stopped again in a precise series of sweeps and pauses. It was a sensation of such grace and power that Lyra, sharing it, felt like a young bird learning to fly. Father Coram, watching from across the table, noted the places where the needle stopped, and watched the little girl holding her hair back from her face and biting her lower lip just a little, her eyes following the needle at first, but then, when its path was settled, looking elsewhere on the dial. Not randomly, though. Father Coram was a chess player, and he knew how chess players looked at a game in play. An expert player seemed to see lines of force and influence on the board, and looked along the important lines and ignored the weak ones. And Lyra's eyes moved the same way, according to some similar magnetic field that she could see, and he couldn't. The needle stopped at the thunderbolt, the infant, the serpent, the elephant, and at a creature Lyra couldn't find a name for, a sort of lizard with big eyes and a tail curled around the twig it stood on. It repeated the sequence time after time, while Lyra watched.
What's that lizard mean?
Said Father Coram, breaking into her concentration.
It don't make sense. I can see what it says, but I must be misreading it. The thunderbolt, I think, is anger. And the child, I think it's me. I was getting the meaning for that lizard thing, but you talked to me, Father Coram, and I lost it. See, it's just floating any old where.
Yes, I see that. I'm sorry, Lyra. You tired now? Do you want to stop?
No, I don't,
she said, but her cheeks were flushed and her eyes bright. She had all the signs of fretful overexcitement, and it was made worse by her long confinement in this stuffy cabin. He looked out of the window. It was nearly dark, and they were travelling along the last stretch of inland water before reaching the coast. Wide brown, scummed expanses of an estuary extended under a dreary sky to a distant group of coal spirit tanks, rusty and cobwebbed with pipework, beside a refinery where a thick smear of smoke ascended reluctantly to join the clouds.
Where are we? Can I go outside just for a bit, Father Coram?
This is Colby Water, the estuary of the River Coal. When we reach the town, we'll tie up by the smoke market and go on foot to the docks. We'll be there in an hour or two.
But it was getting dark, and in the wide desolation of the creek, nothing was moving but their own boat and a distant coal barge labouring toward the refinery. And Lyra was so flushed and tired, and she'd been inside for so long. And so Father Coram went on.
Well, I don't suppose it'll matter just for a few minutes in the open air. I wouldn't call it fresh, tent fresh, except when it's blowing off the sea. but you can sit out on top and look around till we get closer in."
Lyra leapt up, and Pantalaimon became a seagull at once, eager to stretch his wings in the open. It was cold outside, and although she was well wrapped up, Lyra was soon shivering. Pantalaimon, on the other hand, leapt into the air with a loud caw of delight, and wheeled and skimmed and darted now ahead of the boat, now behind the stern. Lyra exulted in it, feeling with him as he flew, and urging him mentally to provoke the old Telamon's cormorant demon into a race. But she ignored him and settled down sleepily on the handle of the tiller, near her man. There was no life out on this bitter brown expanse, and only the steady chug of the engine and the subdued splashing of the water under the bows broke the wide silence. Heavy clouds hung low without offering rain. The air beneath was grimy with smoke. Only Pantalaimon's flashing elegance had anything in it of life and joy. As he soared up out of a dive with wide wings white against the grey, something black hurtled at him and struck. He fell sideways in a flutter of shock and pain, and Lyra cried out, feeling it sharply. Another little black thing joined the first. They moved not like birds, but like flying beetles, heavy and direct, and with a droning sound. As Pantalaimon fell, trying to twist away and make for the boat and Lyra's desperate arms, the black things kept driving into him, droning, buzzing, and murderous. Lyra was nearly mad with Pantalaimon's fear and her own, but then something swept past her and upwards. It was the Tillerman's demon, and clumsy and heavy as she looked, her flight was powerful and swift. Her head snapped this way and that. There was a flutter of black wings, a shiver of white, and a little black thing fell to the tarred roof of the cabin at Lyra's feet just as Pantalaimon landed on her outstretched hand. Before she could comfort him, he changed into his wildcat shape and sprang down on the creature, batting it back from the edge of the roof where it was crawling swiftly to escape. Pantalaimon held it firmly down with a needle-filled paw and looked up at the darkening sky, where the black wing flaps of the cormorant were circling higher as she cast around for the other. Then the cormorant glided swiftly back and croaked something to the tiller man, who said,
"It's gone! Don't let that other one escape! Here!"
And he flung the dregs out of the tin mug he'd been drinking from and tossed it to Lyra. She clapped it over the creature at once. It buzzed and snarled like a little machine.
"Hold it still!"
said Father Coram from behind her, and then he was kneeling to slip a piece of card under the mug.
"What is it, Father Coram?"
"Let's go below and have a look. Take it careful, Lyra. Hold that tight."
She looked at the Tillerman's demon as she passed, intending to thank her, but her old eyes were closed. She thanked the Tillerman instead.
"You ought to stay below,"
was all he said. She took the mug into the cabin where Father Coram had found a beer glass. He held the tin mug upside down over it and then slipped the card out from between them so that the creature fell into the glass. He held it up so they could see the angry little thing clearly. It was about as long as Lyra's thumb, and dark green, not black. Its wing cases were erect, like a ladybird's about to fly, and the wings inside were beating so furiously that they were only a blur. Its six clawed legs were scrabbling on the smooth glass.
"What is it?"
Pantalaimon, a wildcat still, crouched on the table 6 inches away, his green eyes following it round and round inside the glass.
"If you was to crack it open, you'd find no living thing in there. No animal nor insect, at any rate. I seen one of these things afore, and I never thought I'd see one again this far north. Afric things. There's a clockwork running in there, and pinned to the spring of it, there's a bad spirit with a spell through its heart."
"But who sent it?"
"You don't even need to read the symbols, Lyra. You can guess as easy as I can."
"Mrs. Coulter?"
"Course. She ain't only explored up north. There's strange things aplenty in the southern wild. It was Morocco where I saw one of these last. Deadly dangerous while the spirit's in it. It won't never stop. And when you let the spirit free, it's so monstrous angry, it'll kill the first thing it gets at."
"But what was it after?"
"Spying. I was a cursed fool to let you up above. And I should have let you think your way through the symbols without interrupting."
"I see it now. It means air, that lizard thing. I saw that, but I couldn't see why, so I tried to work it out, and I lost it."
"Ah, then I see it too. It ain't the lizard. That's why. It's a chameleon. And it stands for air, because they don't eat nor drink. They just live on air."
"And the elephant?"
"Africa. Ah."
They looked at each other. With every revelation of the alethiometer's power, they became more awed by it.
"It was telling warning us about these things all the time. We ought to have listened. But what can we do about this, Invader Corum? Can we kill it or something?
I don't know as we can do anything. We shall just have to keep him shut up tight in a box and never let him out. What worries me more is the other one has got away. He'll be a-flying back to Mrs. Coulter now with the news that he's seen you. Damn me, Lyra, but I'm a fool.
He rattled about in a cupboard and found a smoke leaf tin about 3 inches in diameter. It had been used for holding screws, but he tipped those out and wiped the inside with a rag before inverting the glass over it with a card still in place over the mouth. After a tricky moment when one of the creature's legs escaped and thrust the tin away with surprising strength, they had it captured and the lid screwed down tight.
As soon as we get about the ship, I'll run some solder around the edge to make sure of it.
But don't clockwork run down?
Ordinary clockwork, yes. But like I said, this one's kept tight wound by the spirit pinned to the end. The more he struggles, the tighter it's wound and the stronger the force is. Now, let's put this fella out the way.
He wrapped the tin in a flannel cloth to stifle the incessant buzzing and droning and stowed it away under his bunk. It was dark now, and Lyra watched through the window as the lights of Colby came closer. The heavy air was thickening into mist, and by the time they tied up at the wharves alongside the smoke market, everything in sight was softened and blurred. The darkness shaded into pearly silver-grey veils laid over the warehouses and the cranes, the wooden market stalls and the granite, many-chimneyed building the market was named after, where day and night fish hung kippering in the fragrant oak-wood smoke. The chimneys were contributing their thickness to the clammy air, and the pleasant reek of smoked herring and mackerel and haddock seemed to breathe out of the very cobbles. Lyra, wrapped up in oilskin and with a large hood hiding her revealing hair, walked along between Father Corum and the Tillerman. All three demons were alert, scouting around corners ahead, watching behind, listening for the slightest footfall. But they were the only figures to be seen. The citizens of Colby were all indoors, probably sipping Geneva beside roaring stoves. They saw no one until they reached the dock, and the first man they saw there was Tony Costa, guarding the gates.
Oh, thank God you got here,
he said quietly, letting them through.
We just heard as Jack Verhoeven's been shot and his boat sunk, and no one had heard where you was. John Fowle's on board already and jumping to go.
The vessel looked immense to Lyra. A wheelhouse and funnel amidships, a high forecastle and a stout derrick over a canvas-covered hatch, yellow light agleam in the portholes and the bridge, and white light at the masthead, and three or four men on deck working urgently at things she couldn't see. She hurried up the wooden gangway ahead of Father Corum and looked around with excitement. Pantalaimon became a monkey and clambered up the derrick at once, but she called him down again. Father Corum wanted them indoors, or below, as you called it, on board ship. Down some stairs, or a companionway, there was a small saloon where John Farr was talking quietly with Nicholas Rokeby, the Egyptian in charge of the vessel. John Farr did nothing hastily. Lyra was waiting for him to greet her, but he finished his remarks about the tide and pilotage before turning to the incomers.
Good evening, friends. Poor Jack Verhoeven's dead, perhaps you've heard, and his boy's captured.
We have bad news, too,
said Father Corum, and told of their encounter with the flying spirits. John Farr shook his great head, but didn't reproach them.
Where is the creature now?
Father Corum took out the leaf tin and laid it on the table. Such a furious buzzing came from it that the tin itself moved slowly over the wood.
I've heard of them clockwork devils, but never seen one. There ain't no way of taming it and turning it back, I do know that much. Nor is it any use weighing it down with lead and dropping it in the ocean. Because one day it'd rush through and out the devil would come and make for the child, whatever she was. No, we'll have to keep it by and exercise our vigilance.
Lyra being the only female on board, for John Farr had decided against taking women after much thought, she had a cabin to herself. Not a grand cabin, to be sure, in fact, little more than a closet with a bunk and a scuttle, which was the proper name for porthole. She stowed her few things in the drawer below the bunk, and ran up excitedly to lean over the rail and watch England vanish behind, only to find that most of England had vanished in the mist before she got there. But the rush of water below, the movement in the air, the ship's lights glowing bravely in the dark, the rumble of the engine, the smells of salt and fish and coal spirit were exciting enough by themselves. It wasn't long before another sensation joined them, as the vessel began to roll in the German Ocean swell. When someone called Lyra down for a bite of supper, She found she was less hungry than she'd thought, and presently she decided it would be a good idea to lie down, for Pantalaimon's sake, because the poor creature was feeling sadly ill at ease. And so began her journey to the north.
That is the end of part one of Northern Lights. The thrilling details of Lyra's journey to the north, including her meeting with the great armored bear, Yorick Birnison, will be found in part two, Bolvangar. You've been listening to His Dark Materials, Book One, Northern Lights, Part One, Oxford. Written and narrated by Philip Pullman. Featured in the cast were Joanna Wyatt as Lyra, Rupert Degas as Pantalaimon and Tony Costa, Sean Barrett as Lord Asriel, Stephen Thorne as the Master and Farda Coram, Douglas Blackwell as the Librarian and John Farr, and Andrew Branch as Trelawney and the Intercessor. The role of Mrs. Coulter was performed by Alison Dowling, and Mar Costa by Jill Schilling. Adele Starminster and Roger were played by Susan Sheridan, and Mrs. Lonsdale by Anne Rosenfeld. Heywood Morse played Wren and the Chaplain, John O'Connor was the Dean, and Liza Ross was Stell Maria. The children were played by Rachel Wolfe, Andrew Lamont, Alexander Mitchell, and Arthur Mitchell. Other roles were played by members of the cast. The executive producers of this recording were Timothy P. Ditlow and Bruce Coville. It was recorded at Heavy Entertainment Studios in London, England, where the engineer was Chris O'Shaughnessy. Wolfgang Dienst was the post-production editor, and the music was composed by Peter Ponson. This has been a Story Circle production directed by Garrick Hagen for Listening Library and Chivers Audiobooks. We do hope you have enjoyed listening to this Chivers audiobook. Bolvangar. What has gone before? In a world much like ours, yet different in many ways, children are disappearing. The children themselves speak in awe of the gobblers. Adults whisper fearfully of the mysterious oblation board. At Jordan College, in a place much like our Oxford, lives a young girl named Lyra Balakwa, who has been sheltered there at the request of her uncle, the commanding Lord Asriel. But the time has come for Lyra to leave, to become an assistant to the coldly beautiful Mrs. Coulter. Lyra takes two things with her, her beloved demon Pan, from whom she is inseparable anyway, of course, and the golden compass, more properly known as the alethiometer, or truth meter, an unusual instrument that came to the college by way of Lord Asriel. But Mrs. Coulter proves a dangerous guardian, and Lyra soon flees her home as well. She and Pan fall in among the Egyptians, a wandering folk with whom she has an old connection. There she meets John Farr, lord of the Western Egyptians, and Farda Coram, an elderly wise man who tells Lyra the startling truth of her background, that Lord Asriel is her father, and Mrs. Coulter her mother. The Egyptians are planning a trip north to try to rescue their children from the gobblers. And Lyra, pursued by Mrs. Coulter's forces, is to go with them, because she has learned to read the golden compass, and with it can help guide them on their dangerous journey.
His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. Book 1, Northern Lights. Part 2, Bolvangar. Chapter 10, The Consul and the Bear. John Farr and the other leaders had decided that they would make for Trollesund, the main port of Lapland. The witches had a consulate in the town, and John Farr knew that without their help, or at least their friendly neutrality, it would be impossible to rescue the captive children. He explained his idea to Lyra and Farda Coram the next day, when Lyra's seasickness had abated slightly. The sun was shining brightly and the green waves were dashing against the bows, bearing white streams of foam as they curved away. Out on the deck, with the breeze blowing and the whole sea a-sparkle with light and movement, she felt little sickness at all. And now that Pantalaimon had discovered the delights of being a seagull and then a stormy petrel and skimming the wavetops, Lyra was too absorbed by his glee to wallow in landlubberly misery. John Farr, Fardacorum, and two or three others sat in the stern of the ship, with the sun full on them, talking about what to do next.
"Now Fardacorum knows these Lapland witches,"
John Farr said.
"And if I ain't mistaken, there's an obligation there."
"That's right, John," said Fardacorum. "It were 40 years back, but that's nothing to a witch. Some of them live to many times that."
"What happened to bring this obligation about, Fardacorum?"
said Adam Stefanski, the man in charge of the fighting troop.
"I saved a witch's life. She fell out of the air, being pursued by a great red bird like to nothing I'd seen before. She fell injured in the marsh, and I set out to find her. She was like to drowning, and I got her on board and shot that bird down, and it fell into a bog, to my regret, for it was as big as a bittern, and flame red."
The other men murmured, captured by Fardacorum's story.
"Now when I got her in the boat, I had the most grim shock I'd ever known, because that young woman had no demon."
It was as if he'd said she had no head. The very thought was repugnant. The men shuddered, their demons bristled or shook themselves or cawed harshly, and the men soothed them. Pantalaimon crept into Lyra's arms, their hearts beating together.
"At least that's what it seemed. Being as she fell out of the air, I more than suspected she was a witch. She looked exactly like a young woman, thinner than some, and prettier than most, but not seeing that demon gave me a hideous turn."
"Ain't they got demons, then, the witches?"
said the other man, Michael Canzona.
"Their demons is invisible, I expect,"
said Adam Stefanski.
"He was there all the time, and Fardacorum never saw him."
"No, you're wrong, Adam. He weren't there at all. The witches have the power to separate themselves from their demons a mighty sight further than what we can. If need be, they can send their demons far abroad on the wind or the clouds or down below the ocean. And this witch I found, she hadn't been resting above a hour when her demon came a-flying back, because he'd felt her fear and her injury, of course. And it's my belief, though she never admitted to this, but the great red bird I shot was another witch's demon in pursuit. Lord, that made me shiver when I thought of that. I'd have stayed my hand. I'd have taken any measures on sea or land. But there it was. Anyway, there was no doubt I'd saved her life. And she gave me a token of it, and said I was to call on her help if ever it was needed. And once she sent me help, when the Skraelin shot me with a poison arrow. We had other connections, too. I haven't seen her from that day to this, but she'll remember."
"And does she live in Tralazon, this witch?"
"No, no, they live in forests and on the tundra, not in the seaport among men and women. Their business is with the wild. But they keep a council there. And I shall get word to her. Make no doubt about that."
Lyra was keen to know more about the witches, but the men had turned their talk to the matter of fuel and stores, and presently she grew impatient to see the rest of the ship. She wandered along the deck towards the bows, and soon made the acquaintance of an able seaman by flicking at him the pips she'd saved from the apple she'd eaten at breakfast. He was a stout and placid man, and when he'd sworn at her and been sworn at in return, they became great friends. He was called Jerry. Under his guidance, she found out that having something to do prevented you from feeling seasick, and that even a job like scrubbing a deck could be satisfying if it was done in a seaman-like way. She was very taken with this notion, and later on she folded the blankets on her bunk in a seaman-like way, and put her possessions in the closet in a seaman-like way, and used stow instead of tidy for the process of doing so. After 2 days at sea, Lyra decided that this was the life for her. She had the run of the ship, from the engine room to the bridge, and she was soon on first-name terms with all the crew. Captain Rokeby let her signal to a Hollands frigate by pulling the handle of the steam whistle. The cook suffered her help in mixing plum duff, and only a stern word from John Farr prevented her from climbing the foremast to inspect the horizon from the crow's nest. All the time they were steaming north, and it grew colder daily. The ship's stores were searched for oilskins that could be cut down for her, and Jerry showed her how to sew, an art she learned willingly from him, though she had scorned it at Jordan and avoided instruction from Mrs. Lonsdale. Together they made a waterproof bag for the alethiometer that she could wear around her waist, in case she fell in the sea, she said. With it safely in place, she clung to the rail in her oilskins and sou'wester as the stinging spray broke over the bows and surged along the deck. She still felt seasick occasionally, especially when the wind got up and the ship plunged heavily over the crests of the grey-green waves, and then it was Pantalaimon's job to distract her from it by skimming the waves as a stormy petrel, because she could feel his boundless glee in the dash of wind and water and forget her nausea. From time to time he even tried being a fish, and once joined a school of dolphins to their surprise and pleasure. Lyra stood shivering in the forecastle and laughed with delight as her beloved Pantalaimon, sleek and powerful, leapt from the water with half a dozen other swift grey shapes. He had to stay close to the ship, of course, for he could never go far from her. But she sensed his desire to speed as far and as fast as he could for pure exhilaration. She shared his pleasure, but for her it wasn't simple pleasure, for there was pain and fear in it, too. Suppose he loved being a dolphin more than he loved being with her on land. What would she do then? Her friend the able seaman was nearby, and he paused as he adjusted the canvas cover of the forward hatch to look out at the little girl's demon skimming and leaping with the dolphins. His own demon, a seagull, had her head tucked under her wing on the capstan. He knew what Lyra was feeling.
When I first went to sea, my belly sorry I hadn't settled on one form, I was that young, and she loved being a porpoise. I was afraid she'd settle like that. There was one old sailorman on my first vessel who could never go ashore at all because his demon had settled as a dolphin and he could never leave the water. Oh, he was a wonderful sailor. Best navigator you ever knew. Could have made a fortune at the fishing, but he wasn't happy at it. He was never quite happy till he died and he could be buried at sea.
Why do demons have to settle? I want Pantalaimon to be able to change forever. So does he.
Oh, they always have settled and they always will. That's part of growing up. There'll come a time when you'll be tired of his changing about and you'll want a settled kind of form for him.
I never will.
Oh, you will. You'll want to grow up like all the other girls. Anyway, there's compensations for a settled form.
What are they?
Knowing what kind of person you are. But take old Belisaria. She's a seagull, and that means I'm a kind of seagull too. I'm not grand and splendid, nor beautiful. But I'm a tough old thing, and I can survive anywhere and always find a bit of food and company. Ah, that's worth knowing, that is. And when your demon settles, you'll know the sort of person you are.
But suppose your demon settles in a shape you don't like?
Well, then, you're discontented, aren't you? There's plenty of folk who'd like to have a lion as a demon, and they end up with a poodle. Until they learn to be satisfied with what they are, they're going to be fretful about it. Waste of feeling, that is.
But it didn't seem to Lyra that she would ever grow up. One morning there was a different smell in the air, and the ship was moving oddly with a brisker rocking from side to side instead of the plunging and soaring. Lyra was on deck a minute after she woke up, gazing greedily at the land. Such a strange sight after all that water, for though they had only been at sea a few days, Lyra felt as if they'd been on the ocean for months. Directly ahead of the ship, a mountain rose, green-flanked and snow-capped, and a little town and harbour lay below it. Wooden houses with steep roofs, an oratory spire, cranes in the harbour, and clouds of gulls wheeling and crying. The smell was of fish, but mixed with it came land smells too, pine resin and earth and something animal and musky, and something else that was cold and blank and wild. It might have been snow. It was the smell of the north. Seals frisked around the ship, showing their clown faces above the water before sinking back without a splash. The wind that lifted spray off the white-capped waves was monstrously cold and searched out every gap in Lyra's wolfskin, and her hands were soon aching and her face numb. Pantalaimon, in his ermine shape, warmed her neck for her, but it was too cold to stay outside for long without work to do, even to watch the seals, and Lyra went below to eat her breakfast porridge and look through the porthole in the saloon. Inside the harbour the water was calm, and as they moved past the massive breakwater Lyra began to feel unsteady from the lack of motion. She and Pantalaimon avidly watched as the ship inched ponderously towards the quayside. During the next hour the sound of the engine died away to a quiet background rumble. Voices shouted orders or queries, ropes were thrown, gangways lowered, hatches opened.
"Come on, Lyra,"
said Vardacorum.
"Is everything packed?"
Lyra's possessions, such as they were, had been packed ever since she'd woken up and seen the land. All she had to do was run to the cabin and pick up the shopping bag, and she was ready. The first thing she and Farda Coram did ashore was to visit the house of the Witch Council. It didn't take long to find it. The little town was clustered around the harbour, with the oratory and the governor's house the only buildings of any size. The Witch Council lived in a green-painted wooden house within sight of the sea, and when they rang the bell it jangled loudly in the quiet street. A servant showed them into a little parlour and brought them coffee. Presently the consul himself came in to greet them. He was a fat man with a florid face and a sober black suit, whose name was Martin Lancelius. His demon was a little serpent, the same intense and brilliant green as his eyes, which were the only witch-like thing about him, though Lyra was not sure what she had been expecting a witch to look like.
How can I help you, Father Coram?
In two ways, Dr. Lancelius. First, I'm anxious to get in touch with a witch lady I met some years ago in the fen country of Eastern Anglia. Her name is Seraphina Pecola.
Dr. Lancelius made a note with a silver pencil.
How long ago was your meeting with her?
Must be 40 years. But I think she would remember.
And what is the second way in which you seek my help?
I'm representing a number of Egyptian families who've lost children. We've got reason to believe there's an organization capturing these children, ours and others, and bringing them to the north for some unknown purpose. I'd like to know whether you or your people have heard of anything like this going on.
Dr. Lancelius sipped his coffee blandly.
It's not impossible that notice of some such activity might have come our way. You realize the relations between my people and the Northlanders are perfectly cordial. It would be difficult for me to justify disturbing them.
Father Coram nodded as if he understood very well.
To be sure. And it wouldn't be necessary for me to ask you if I could get the information any other way. That was why I asked about the witch lady first.
Now Dr. Lancelius nodded as if he understood. Lyra watched this game with puzzlement and respect. There were all kinds of things going on beneath it, and she saw that the witch council was coming to a decision.
Very well. Of course that's true, and you'll realize that your name is not unknown to us, Father Coram. Seraphina Pecola is queen of a witch clan in the region of Lake Enara. As for your other question, it is of course understood that this information is not reaching you through me.
Quite so.
Well, in this very town there is a branch of an organization called the Northern Progress Exploration Company, which pretends to be searching for minerals, but which is really controlled by something called the General Oblation Board of London. This organization, I happen to know, imports children. This is not generally known in the town. The Norway government is not officially aware of it. The children don't remain here long. They are taken some distance inland.
Do you know where, Dr. Lancelius?
No, I would tell you if I did.
And do you know what happens to them there?
For the first time, Dr. Lancelius glanced at Lyra. She looked stolidly back. The little green serpent demon raised her head from the consul's collar and whispered tongue-flickeringly in his ear. The consul said,
I have heard the phrase the Meierstadt process in connection with this matter. I think they use that in order to avoid calling what they do by its proper name. I have also heard the word intercision, but what it refers to I could not say.
And are there any children in the town at the moment?
He was stroking his demon's fur as she sat alert in his lap. Lyra noticed that she had stopped purring.
No, I think not. A group of about 12 arrived a week ago and moved out the day before yesterday.
Ah, as recent as that. Then that gives us a bit of hope. How did they travel, Dr. Lancelius?
By sledge.
And you have no idea where they went?
Very little. It's not a subject we're interested in.
Quite so. Now, you've answered all my questions very fairly, sir. And here's just one more. If you were me, what question would you ask of the Council of the Witches?
For the first time, Dr. Lancelius smiled.
I would ask where I could obtain the services of an armoured bear.
Lyra sat up and felt Pantalaimon's heart leap in her hands.
I understood the armoured bears to be in the service of the Oblation Board. I mean, the Northern Progress Company, or whatever they're calling themselves.
There is at least one who is not. You will find him at the sledge depot at the end of Langlokur Street. He earns a living there at the moment, but such is his temper and the fear he engenders in the dogs, his employment might not last for long.
Is he a renegade, then?
It seems so. His name is Jorek Birnison. You asked what I would ask, and I told you. Now here is what I would do. I would seize the chance to employ an armored bear, even if it were far more remote than this.
Lyra could hardly sit still. Father Coram, however, knew the etiquette for meetings such as this, and took another spiced honey cake from the plate. While he ate it, Dr. Lancelius turned to Lyra.
I understand that you are in possession of an alethiometer,
he said, to her great surprise, for how could he have known that?
Yes,
she said, and then, prompted by a nip from Pantalaimon, added,
would you like to look at it?
Oh, I should like that very much.
She fished inelegantly in the oilskin pouch and handed him the velvet package. He unfolded it and held it up with great care, gazing at the face like a scholar gazing at a rare manuscript.
How exquisite! I have seen one other example, but it was not so fine as this. And do you possess the books of readings?
No.
Lyra began, but before she could say any more, Father Coram was speaking.
No, the great pity is that although Lyra possesses the alethiometer itself, there's no means of reading it whatsoever. It's just as much of a mystery as the pools of ink the Hindus use for reading the future. And the nearest book of readings I know of is in the Abbey of St. Johann at Heidelberg.
Lyra could see why he was saying this. He didn't want Dr. Lancelius to know of Lyra's power. But she could also see something Father Coram couldn't, which was the agitation of Dr. Lancelius's demon, and she knew at once that it was no good to pretend. So she said,
actually, I can read it,
speaking half to Dr. Lancelius and half to Father Coram, and it was the consul who responded.
That is wise of you. Where did you obtain this one?
The master of Jordan College in Oxford gave it to me. Dr. Lancelius, do you know who made them?
They are said to originate in the city of Prague. The scholar who invented the first alethiometer was apparently trying to discover a way of measuring the influences of the planets according to the ideas of astrology. He intended to make a device that would respond to the idea of Mars or Venus as a compass responds to the idea of North. In that he failed, but the mechanism he invented was clearly responding to something, even if no one knew what it was.
And where did they get the symbols from?
Oh, this was in the 17th century. Symbols and emblems were everywhere. Buildings and pictures were designed to be read like books. Everything stood for something else. If you had the right dictionary, you could read nature itself. It was hardly surprising to find philosophers using the symbolism of their time to interpret knowledge that came from a mysterious source. But, you know, they haven't been used seriously for 2 centuries or so.
He handed the instrument back to Lyra and added,
may I ask a question? Without the books of symbols, how do you read it?
I just make my mind go clear, and then it's sort of like looking down into water. You've got to let your eyes find the right level, because that's the only one that's in focus. Something like that.
I wonder if I might ask to see you do it?
Lyra looked at Father Coram, wanting to say yes, but waiting for his approval. The old man nodded.
What shall I ask?
What are the intentions of the Tatars with regard to Kamchatka?
That wasn't hard. Lyra turned the hands to the camel, which meant Asia, which meant Tatars, to the cornucopia for Kamchatka, where there were gold mines, and to the ant, which meant activity, which meant purpose and intention. Then she sat still, letting her mind hold the 3 levels of meaning together in focus, and relaxed for the answer which came almost at once. The long needle trembled on the dolphin, the helmet, the baby, and the anchor, dancing between them and on to the crucible in a complicated pattern that Lyra's eyes followed without hesitation, but which was incomprehensible to the 2 men. When it had completed the movement several times, Lyra looked up. She blinked once or twice as if she were coming out of a trance.
They're going to pretend to attack it, but they're not really going to, because it's too far away, and they'd be too stretched out.
Would you tell me how you read that?
The dolphin. One of its deep-down meanings is playing, sort of like being playful. I know it's the 15th because it stopped 15 times, and it just got clear at that level but nowhere else. And the helmet means war, and both together they mean pretend to go to war, but not be serious. And the baby means, it means difficult. It'd be too hard for them to attack it, and the anchor says why. Because they'd be stretched out as tight as an anchor rope. I just see it all like that, you see.
Dr. Lancelius nodded.
Remarkable. I'm very grateful. I shall not forget that.
Then he looked strangely at Fardacorum and back at Lyra.
Could I ask you for one more demonstration? If you look out of this window, you'll see a shed with 40 or more sprays of cloud pine hanging on the wall. One of them has been used by Seraphina Pecola, and the others have not. Could you tell which is hers?
Yeah,
said Lyra, always ready to show off, and she took the alethiometer and hurried out. She was eager to see cloud pine because the witches used it for flying, and she'd never seen any before. The two men stood by the window and watched as she kicked her way through the snow. Pantaline went bouncing beside her as a hare, to stand in front of the wooden shed, head down, manipulating the alethiometer. After a few seconds, she reached forward and unhesitatingly picked out one of the many sprays of pine and held it up. Dr. Lancelius nodded. Lyra, intrigued and eager to fly, held it above her head and jumped and ran about in the snow, trying to be a witch. The consul turned to Fardacorum and said,
Do you realize who this child is?
She's the daughter of Lord Asriel, and her mother is Mrs. Coulter of the Oblation Board.
And apart from that?
The old Egyptian had to shake his head.
No, I don't know any more. But she's a strange, innocent creature, and I wouldn't have her harmed for the world. How she comes to read that instrument, I couldn't guess. But I believe her when she talks of it. Why, Dr. Lancelius, what do you know about her?
The witches have talked about this child for centuries past. Because they live so close to the place where the veil between the worlds is thin, they hear immortal whispers from time to time in the voices of those beings who pass between the worlds. And they have spoken of a child such as this, who has a great destiny that can only be fulfilled elsewhere. Not in this world, but far beyond. Without this child we shall all die, so the witches say. But she must fulfill this destiny in ignorance of what she is doing, because only in her ignorance can we be saved. Do you understand that, Father Corum?
No, I'm unable to say that I do.
What it means is that she must be free to make mistakes. We must hope that she does not, but we can't guide her. I'm glad to have seen this child before I die.
But how did you recognize her as being that particular child? And what did you mean about the beings who pass between the worlds? Well, I'm at a loss to understand you, Dr. Lancelius, for all that I judge you're an honest man.
But before the consul could answer, the door opened and Lyra came in, bearing a little branch of pine.
This is the one! I tested them all, and this is it, I'm sure. But it won't fly for me.
Well, Lyra, that is remarkable. You're lucky to have an instrument like that. I wish you well with it. I would like to give you something to take away with you.
He took the spray and broke off a twig for her.
Did she really fly with this?
Yes, she did. But then she is a witch, and you are not. I can't give you all of it because I need it to contact her, but this will be enough. Look after it.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
And she tucked it into her purse beside the alethiometer. Fardacorum touched the spray of pine as if for luck, and on his face was an expression Lyra had never seen before, almost a longing. The consul showed them to the door, where he shook hands with Fardacorum, and shook Lyra's hand too.
I hope you find success,
he said, and stood on his doorstep in the piercing cold to watch them up the little street.
He knew the answer about the Tartars before I did,
Lyra told Fardacorum.
The alethiometer told me, but I never said. It was the crucible.
I expect he was testing you, child. But you done right to be polite, being as we can't be sure what he knows already. And that was a useful tip about the bear. I don't know how we would have heard otherwise.
They found their way to the depot, which was a couple of concrete warehouses in a scrubby area of waste ground, where thin weeds grew between grey rocks and pools of icy mud. A surly man in an office told them that they could find the bear off duty at 6, but they'd have to be quick, because he usually went straight to the yard behind Einarsson's bar, where they gave him drink. Then Fardacorum took Lyra to the best outfitters in town and bought her some proper cold-weather clothing. They bought a parka made of reindeer skin, because reindeer hair is hollow and insulates well. The hood was lined with wolverine fur, because that sheds the ice that forms when you breathe. They bought underclothing and boot liners of reindeer calfskin, and silk gloves to go inside big fur mittens. The boots and mittens were made of skin from the reindeer's forelegs, because that is extra tough, and the boots were soled with the skin of the bearded seal, which is as tough as walrus hide, but lighter. Finally, they bought a waterproof cape that enveloped her completely, made of semi-transparent seal intestine. With all that on, and a silk muffler around her neck and a woolen cap over her ears and the big hood pulled forward, she was uncomfortably warm. But they were going to much colder regions than this. John Farr had been supervising the unloading of the ship, and was keen to hear about the witch consul's words, and even keener to learn of the bear.
"We'll go to him this very evening. Have you ever spoken to such a creature, Father Coram?"
"Yes, I have, and fought one too, though not by myself, thank God. We must be ready to treat with him, John. He'll ask a lot, I've no doubt, and be surly and difficult to manage, but we must have him."
"Oh, we must. And what of your witch?"
"Well, she's a long way off, and a clan queen now. I did hope it might be possible for a message to reach her, but it would take too long to wait for a reply."
Well, now let me tell you what I found, old friend."
For John Farr had been fidgeting with impatience to tell them something. He had met a prospector on the quayside, a new Dane from the country of Texas, and this man had a balloon of all things. The expedition he'd been hoping to join had failed for lack of funds even before it had left Amsterdam, so he was stranded.
"Think what we might do with the help of an aeronaut, Father Coram,"
said John Farr, rubbing his great hands together.
"I've engaged him to sign up with us. Seems to me we struck luckier coming here."
"Luckier still if we had a clear idea of where we were going,"
said Father Coram, but nothing could damp John Farr's pleasure in being on campaign once more. After darkness had fallen, and when the stores and equipment had all been safely unloaded and stood in waiting on the quay, Father Coram and Lyra walked along the waterfront and looked for Einarsson's bar. They found it easily enough, a crude concrete shed with a red neon sign flashing irregularly over the door, and the sound of loud voices through the condensation-frosted windows. A pitted alley beside it led to a sheet-metal gate into a rear yard, where a lean-to shed stood crazily over a floor of frozen mud. Dim yellow light through the rear window of the bar showed a vast, pale form, crouching upright and gnawing at a haunch of meat which it held in both hands. Lyra had an impression of blood-stained muzzle and face, small malevolent black eyes, and an immensity of dirty, matted, yellowish fur. As it gnawed, hideous growling, crunching, sucking noises came from it. Father Coram stood by the gate and called.
"Yorak Bjornason?"
The bear stopped eating. As far as they could tell, he was looking at them directly, but it was impossible to read any expression on his face.
"Yorak Bjornason? May I speak to you?"
Lyra's heart was thumping hard, because something in the bear's presence made her feel close to coldness, danger, brutal power, but a power controlled by intelligence. And not a human intelligence, nothing like a human, because, of course, bears had no demons. This strange, hulking presence gnawing its meat was like nothing she had ever imagined, and she felt a profound admiration and pity for the lonely creature. He dropped the reindeer leg in the dirt and slumped on all fours to the gate. Then he reared up massively, 10 feet or more high, as if to show how mighty he was, to remind them how useless the gate would be as a barrier, and he spoke to them from that height.
"Well, who are you?"
His voice was so deep it seemed to shake the earth. The rank smell that came from his body was almost overpowering.
"I'm Father Coram, from the Egyptian people of Eastern Anglia, and this little girl is Lyra Belacqua."
"What do you want?"
"We want to offer you employment, Yorick Bjornason."
"I am employed."
The bear dropped on all fours again. It was very hard to detect any expressive tones in his voice, whether of irony or anger, because it was so deep and so flat.
"What do you do at the sledge depot?"
"I mend broken machinery and articles of iron. I lift heavy objects."
"What kind of work is that for a Panzerbjörn?"
"Paid work."
Behind the bear, the door of the bar opened a little way and a man put down a large earthenware jar before looking up to peer at them.
"Who's that?"
he said.
"Strangers," said the bear.
The bartender looked as if he was going to ask something more, but the bear lurched towards him suddenly and the man shut the door in alarm. The bear hooked a claw through the handle of the jar and lifted it to his mouth. Lyra could smell the tang of the raw spirits that splashed out. After swallowing several times, the bear put the jar down and turned back to gnaw his haunch of meat, heedless of Fardacorum and Lyra, it seemed. But then he spoke again.
What work are you offering?
Fighting, in all probability. We're moving north until we find a place where they've taken some children captive. When we find it, we'll have to fight to get the children free, and then we'll bring them back.
And what will you pay?
I don't know what to offer you, Yorick Bjørnason. If gold is desirable to you, we have gold.
No good.
What do they pay you at the sledge depot?
My keep here in meat and spirits.
Silence from the bear. And then he dropped the ragged bone and lifted the jar to his muzzle again, drinking the powerful spirits like water.
Forgive me for asking, Yorick Bjørnason, but you could live a free, proud life on the ice, hunting seals and walruses, or you could go to war and win great prizes. What ties you to Trollesund and Einarsson's bar?
Lyra felt her skin shiver all over. She would have thought a question like that, which was almost an insult, would enrage the great creature beyond reason, and she wondered at Fardacorum's courage in asking it. Yorick Bjørnason put down his jar and came close to the gate to peer at the old man's face. Fardacorum didn't flinch.
I know the people you are seeking, the child cutters. They left town the day before yesterday to go north with more children. No one will tell you about them. They pretend not to see because the child cutters bring money and business. Now, I don't like the child cutters, so I shall answer you politely. I stay here and drink spirits, because the men here took my armor away, and without that, I can hunt seals, but I can't go to war. And I am an armored bear. War is the sea I swim in and the air I breathe. The men of this town gave me spirits and let me drink till I was asleep, and then they took my armor away from me. If I knew where they keep it, I would tear down the town to get it back. If you want my service, the price is this. Get me back my armor. Do that, and I shall serve you in your campaign, either until I am dead or until you have a victory. The price is my armor. I want it back. And then I shall never need spirits again.
Chapter 11. Armor. When they returned to the ship, Fardacorum and John Farr and the other leaders spent a long time in conference in the saloon, and Lyra went to her cabin to consult the alethiometer. Within 5 minutes she knew exactly where the bear's armor was, and why it would be difficult to get it back. She wondered whether to go to the saloon and tell John Farr and the others, but decided that they'd ask her if they wanted to know. Perhaps they knew already. She lay on her bunk thinking of that savage, mighty bear, and the careless way he drank his fiery spirit, and the loneliness of him in his dirty lean-to. How different it was to be human, with one's demon always there to talk to. In the silence of the still ship, without the continual creak of metal and timber, or the rumble of the engine, or the rush of water along the side, Lyra gradually fell asleep, with Pantalaimon on her pillow, sleeping too. She was dreaming of her great imprisoned father when suddenly, for no reason at all, she woke up. She had no idea what time it was. There was a faint light in the cabin that she took for moonlight, and it showed her new cold-weather furs that lay stiffly in the corner of the cabin. No sooner did she see them than she longed to try them on again. Once they were on, she had to go out on deck, and a minute later she opened the door at the top of the companionway and stepped out. At once she saw that something strange was happening in the sky. She thought it was clouds, moving and trembling under a nervous agitation, but Pantalaimon whispered,
"The aurora!"
Her wonder was so strong that she had to clutch the rail to keep from falling. The sight filled the northern sky. The immensity of it was scarcely conceivable. As if from heaven itself, great curtains of delicate light hung and trembled. Pale green and rose pink, and as transparent as the most fragile fabric, and at the bottom edge a profound and fiery crimson like the fires of hell, They swung and shimmered loosely with more grace than the most skillful dancer. Lyra thought she could even hear them, a vast, distant, whispering swish. In the evanescent delicacy, she felt something as profound as she'd felt close to the bear. She was moved by it. It was so beautiful it was almost holy. She felt tears prick her eyes, and the tears splintered the light even further into prismatic rainbows. It wasn't long before she found herself entering the same kind of trance as when she consulted the alethiometer. Perhaps, she thought calmly, whatever moves the alethiometer's needle is making the aurora glow, too. It might even be dust itself. She thought that without noticing that she thought it, and she soon forgot it, and only remembered it much later. And as she gazed, the image of a city seemed to form itself behind the veils and streams of translucent color. Towers and domes, honey-colored temples and colonnades, broad boulevards and sunlit parkland. Looking at it gave her a sense of vertigo, as if she were looking not up but down, and across a gulf so wide that nothing could ever pass over it. It was a whole universe away. But something was moving across it, and as she tried to focus her eyes on the movement, she felt faint and dizzy, because the little thing moving wasn't part of the aurora or of the other universe behind it. It was in the sky over the roofs of the town. When she could see it clearly, she had come fully awake, and the sky city was gone. The flying thing came closer and circled the ship on outspread wings. Then it glided down and landed with brisk sweeps of its powerful pinions and came to a halt on the wooden deck a few yards from Lyra. In the aurora's light she saw a great bird, a beautiful grey goose whose head was crowned with a flash of pure white. And yet it wasn't a bird. It was a demon, though there was no one in sight but Lyra herself. The idea filled her with sickly fear. The bird said,
"Where is Father Coram?"
And suddenly Lyra realized who it must be. This was the demon of Serafina Pekala, the clan queen, Father Coram's witch friend. She stammered to reply,
I'll go and get him.
She turned and scampered down the companionway to the cabin Father Coram occupied, and opened the door to speak into the darkness.
Father Coram! The witch's demon's come! He's waiting on the deck! He flew here all by himself! I seen him coming in the sky!
Ask him to wait on the after-deck, child.
The goose made his stately way to the stern of the ship, where he looked around, elegant and wild simultaneously, and a cause of fascinated terror to Lyra, who felt as though she were entertaining a ghost. Then Father Coram came up, wrapped in his cold-weather gear, closely followed by John Farr. Both old men bowed respectfully, and their demons also acknowledged the visitor.
Greetings, and I'm happy and proud to see you again, Geyser. Now, would you like to come inside, or would you prefer to stay out here in the open?
I would rather stay outside, thank you, Father Coram. Are you warm enough for a while?
Witches and their demons felt no cold, but they were aware that other humans did. Father Coram assured him that they were well wrapped up, and said,
How is Serafina Pekala?
She sends her greetings to you, Father Coram, and she is well and strong. Who are these two people?
Father Coram introduced them both. The goose demon looked hard at Lyra.
I have heard of this child. She is talked about among witches. So you have come to make war.
Not war, Kaiser. We're going to free the children taken from us. And I hope the witches will help.
Not all of them will. Some clans are working with the Dust Hunters.
Is that what you call the Oblation Board?
I don't know what this board may be. They are Dust Hunters. They came to our regions 10 years ago with philosophical instruments. They paid us to allow them to set up stations in our lands, and they treated us with courtesy.
What is this dust?
It comes from the sky. Some say it has always been there. Some say it is newly falling. What is certain is that when people become aware of it, a great fear comes over them, and they'll stop at nothing to discover what it is. But it is not of any concern to witches.
And where are they now, these dust hunters?
4 days northeast of here, at a place called Bolvangar. Our clan made no agreement with them, and because of our long-standing obligation to you, Father Coram, I have come to show you how to find these dust hunters.
Father Coram smiled, and John Farr clapped his great hands together in satisfaction.
Thank you kindly, sir. But tell us this. Do you know anything more about these dust hunters?
What do they do at this Bolvanga?
They have put up buildings of metal and concrete and some underground chambers. They burn coal spirit, which they bring in at great expense. We don't know what they do, but there is an air of hatred and fear over the place, and for